public opinions about policing, the start of Hanukkah, and the man who invented Christmas. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Christine DiMatte, filling in for Luis Hernandez. A new survey examines the public's view of law enforcement in Miami-Dade. Opinions differ greatly across generations and ethnicities. We'll explore the results. Plus, Hanukkah may be the most well-known holiday to non-Jews, but how important is it within the Jewish faith? We'll discuss some of its history. Finally,
Scrooge.
Shut the window. You think I'm made of money?
The Man Who Invented Christmas explores how Charles Dickens created A Christmas Carol. It's a novel and a major film, and now a local theater company has adapted it for an online audience. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Christine DiMatte, filling in for Luis Hernandez. First off, I just wanted to thank the thousands of listeners who supported us during our winter membership campaign. A heartfelt thank you. You guys were terrific. If you're walking through your neighborhood and you spot a police officer, either on the street or in a squad car, what's your first thought? How do you feel? If you're driving and hear police sirens right behind you, what goes through your mind? Well, when it comes to the trust that communities place in police officers and police departments, a new poll of people who live in Miami-Dade County finds some big gaps along racial, ethnic, and generational lines. The survey was commissioned by the United Faculty of Miami-Dade College and conducted by the polling firm Ben Dixon and Amandi. We're speaking with Dr. Minka Brantley, professor of psychology at Miami-Dade College. Also joining us is Samantha Carlo, associate professor in the school's Department of Criminal Justice. They helped formulate the questions behind the poll and have been analyzing the results. Minka, Samantha, thanks for joining us today via Zoom.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Minka, let me begin with you. What conversations were you having with Samantha and your peers at Miami-Dade College about police accountability and criminal justice reform back in the early summer that led to this study?
Well, thanks again for having us. And I think that a lot of us were having conversations this summer. One thing that happened in 2020 is it kind of forced us to sit in front of this national stage and look at what was going on in our community. And so I think a collection of professors, we wanted to know how we could, you know, how we could contribute to this and make it better. And so we started asking and looking for data and research and information so that we could start to spark some conversations and maybe spark some change in our community.
Now, Minka, has there been a community survey commission like this in Miami-Dade's history so far?
No, it's not. It's the first countywide comprehensive and scientific, obviously we're professors, survey that we decided that was really important to us to ask these questions and really look at the community. And that's why it's called the Mirror Project. It's really a testament of looking at the community and the community looking at itself and seeing how we could move forward and make change in Miami-Dade County.
And other communities throughout Florida are very much different than Miami-Dade County. So how about surveys like this elsewhere in Florida or in the United States for that matter?
I can't speak to the United States, but I do know that in Florida, this is something that we have not seen before, especially a collection of professors that really want to examine what's going on outside our windows. And we're, you know, professors are members of the community. And so for us, we are, you know, our students are in this community, the police are in this community, and we really wanted to figure out what we can do to make it better. And we haven't seen something like this before. It was a pretty large survey that was conducted by the institution.
And Samantha, this question's for you. First off, can I call you Sam?
Of course, not a problem.
Good. You call me Chris, okay?
Thank you, Chris.
What were some of the key questions, Sam, that you were hoping to have resolved through this survey?
I think as a collective, we wanted to see if race or ethnicity really contributed to how people perceive law enforcement. We also were curious about some of the language that has developed over this year and this summer in particular, like the language defund the police and see how people interpreted that. We also were very curious about how people felt about the allocation of resources devoted to law enforcement and if there were recommendations to use funding in a different way to address the true issues of crime causation and not being so reactive to crime with road patrol officers and law enforcement officers on the street, but more of a preventative type of approach.
Now, both of you work together teaching at local prisons over the past 7 years. Am I right?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Right. And Lincoln and I started a higher education in prison program at Miami-Dade College as a result of doing some non-academic, more psychosocial programming inside the prisons. We realized how much intelligence and how much hunger for education that there is inside prison. And so when we're not in a pandemic, Mink and I are usually in prison 2 full days a week.
Now, Minka, you're a professor of psychology. Sam, criminologist. And criminology, now you can correct me if I'm wrong, is more than just Lenny Briscoe from Law and Order knocking at your door showing a badge. You know, that's not criminology, okay? Criminology looks, you know, through a social perspective at crime, the people who commit crime, why they commit crime. Stop me if I'm wrong here, okay?
No, you're absolutely right. And the way I approach my teaching is more of like a social justice, not so much criminal justice. And that encapsulates everything that you mentioned.
So when, Minka, this is for you. When the two of you were teaching in the prisons, how does talking to the people who have committed crimes just inform your understanding of the criminal justice system? How does it deepen your knowledge?
Oh, well, I mean, it's one of those transformational experiences that you can have. I'll say that I am not a criminal, criminology professor. I'm, like you said, I'm a psychologist, and I've always been interested in this arena. But when you step into that building and you sit side by side with the incarcerated folks, you realize, and you know, we knew this going in, but you really, it's illuminated that these are sons, fathers, we primarily work with men, and community members. And I remember sitting in that room and looking around and thinking, after Sam taught me this, that 95% of these individuals will be released and returned to our community. And what are we doing to ensure that once they're released, that they can be successful and return as successful contributors to our society? So it's anyone we've brought in with us, they always tell us it's such a life changing experience, and it is truly transformational at its core.
Now, Minka, your dad is a retired Miami-Dade police officer, so I'm sure around that dinner table you have had some lively conversations about your work. Each of you.
Well, I have to say, you know, one of my earliest memories, and of course I'm born and raised in Miami, but one of my earliest memories is walking in, I think, a Winn-Dixie, and a man walked up to my father and shook his hand and said, "Good afternoon, Sergeant Davis." And I just looked up and I said, "Daddy, who's that man?" And he goes, "Oh, I arrested him a few months back." And I think from that perspective, yeah, that didn't happen only once. It happened on several occasions. And I think me seeing that helped me to kind of understand that, you know, police officers are members of the community, and that policing can be done well, where there's mutual respect between the person who may have been arrested and the officer who did that arresting, which is kind of a cognitive dissonance for most people when I kind of tell that story.
And in a second, we're going to talk more fully about how parents and their kids are discussing these matters with each other. Right now, I'm speaking with Dr. Minka Brantley, professor of psychology at Miami-Dade College. Also joining us is Samantha Carlo, associate professor in the school's Department of Criminal Justice. A new survey conducted by Ben Dixon and Amande examined how people in Miami-Dade view law enforcement, their relationships with the community, and where there are opportunities for reform. We have tweeted a link about the study on our social media at WLRN Sundial. So Sam, let's dig into some of the key findings of this poll. One of the striking takeaways from the get-go is that the majority of the people who responded, regardless of race, have a favorable view of law enforcement in the community. That jumped out at me. Now, as someone who's been studying criminal justice for years, did that surprise you?
I can't say that it surprised me. I think overall, all of us are raised to have some type of respect towards law enforcement and understand that they have an important job to do, and understand that the first thing that happens when we're in trouble is we call 911 and we expect that they are going to respond. So that it didn't surprise me, I think, maybe as much as it surprised you. I think an interesting point of reference, though, is that the support for law enforcement is considerably lower than people in other public sector jobs, like nurses and firefighters and teachers.
And that must hurt. That must hurt. And about things hurting, I'm gonna go to Minka a second. You know, Minka, what does it do to police officers when nurses, doctors, especially during a pandemic, are regarded as heroes? And they are. Firefighters, heroes. And police officers are not. What does that do to them psychologically?
You're right. It hurts, because if you think about it, when you ask, you know, the children you might have seen during Halloween dress up as police officers, and we have an academy at our college, and a lot of those transition into local law enforcement roles. And when you ask those who enter into this field, why did you enter into it? They don't say, because I want to be on television, or I want to, you know, I want to hurt people. They say, because I want to help people. And so if you go into a profession with the intention of helping, and then along the way there is some changes that take place, it's really damaging to your psyche. And it also, it's possible that it could feel like maybe it isn't a we are in this together. It might feel more like an us them. And I don't think that that is even anything that might be on the top of the mind, but it is something that will be felt by that officer.
Now, in this study, there were a number of places where there were critical differences. For one, and this surprised a lot of people under the age of 30 were more likely than their older peers to believe that there's systemic racism in law enforcement. In other words, more people under the age of 30 are to believe that there are racists in police departments. Okay, so I hark back to a phrase that was popularized in the 1960s, never trust anybody over 30. So this is, once again, regardless of race, young people under the age of 30 are regarding police departments with suspicion. So, I mean, when you have, first of all, I have to ask Sam, what does this do in terms of recruiting? Because logically, don't police departments recruit out of this age range here? In people in their 20s.
For sure, yeah. Some departments hire 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, some 21. So I definitely think that this kind of compromises the recruiting class a little bit if people have that sentiment. But I also think that people are able to separate themselves and say, well, I'm going to be the good officer. I'm not going to be like those officers that I don't trust. So I think people are capable of kind of separating that. But I definitely think people under 30 are much more connected to social media, much more connected to social movements. And so I think that leads this age group, and this is primarily who we teach, to be a little bit more suspicious of authority, and even feel that some authority is delegitimized because of what they've seen.
And Minka, from once again, from a psychological point of view, when you've got young police officers and young protesters standing opposite each other, and these are people who, if they were in like a gym situation or a bar or club situation, would be partying together. They're the same generation, having fun, but they're standing across from each other with this huge gulf, this huge ravine between them. What does it do to them psychologically on both sides?
Well, it's one of those things where when we have these roles, right, when we assumed a role, we kind of take on the stereotypical idea of what that role really means. And if we're looking at those who are under 30, and I think it's important to kind of note that they are witnessing the world through their phones. There's evidence all around them. Whether or not that evidence is biased or not, there are images coming in through in their pockets, on their phones, telling them how to, giving them information about what's happening in the world when it comes to community and police relations. So when we're walking around with this much information, under 30, that's where they're getting it. And that's going to inform how we're going to interact with one another. But they're also on a stage to some degree when they're out there and standing against officers and vice versa. So I think it's important to kind of think about, not only are we talking about under 30, because I know you referenced, you know, in the 60s, but think about someone under 30 in 2020. That person is a little bit different in that the use of technology impacts how their ideas are informed and created. Yeah, definitely. So I use the example when I talked to my father. I said, you know, when you might have, you know, heard about, and he was active, obviously, in civil rights, when you thought about that, and when you heard stories, you had to wait until Jimmy came, your neighbor came and told you what was going on. Right now, all day long, we're getting information about what's going on in the world. So it definitely informs how we create perceptions and interact with one another.
Okay, in a second, I'm going to get to more information that the poll yielded about attitudes over defunding the police. And that's a long discussion, so I'll get to that in half a second. I would like to go back in time from people's 20s to early childhood, Minka and Sam. Let's talk for a second about the talk, what's commonly known as the talk. Now, I got to tell you, growing up as I did in a white middle-class neighborhood where there was hardly any crime, here is how the talk went with me and my parents. It was like they would look at me and my brother and go, John, Christine, if ever you're in trouble, you look for a policeman. You look for somebody with that badge, with that uniform. The talk with black parents, Minka, goes very differently, doesn't it?
It does. I'm one of five children. I have three brothers. And my father, being a police officer, expressed, as many black children are told, you have to be at the top of your game at all times. You have to always try harder. You always have to be on and paying attention. So my brother goes to get his first car and he wants to, you know, soup it up. And my father's saying, you know what, that might not be the case, because although my father is an officer, he's also a black man, right? And so he knows that even though his sons might be out there and wanting to enjoy their youth, he knows that there are some serious things that can come as a result of that. And he wanted to prepare them for it. And it wasn't, you know, we talk about the talk as if it's one, but I think it ends up being a series of talks. There are boosters as you're going to, you know, think about a shot, right? As you walk out the front door, there's reminders about, just remember, don't get too comfortable, because, you know, it may not be so dangerous for you out there.
And it's draining. And that's one of the things that the survey revealed, is that, and this is one thing that I found heartening about the results of the survey, is that people along all racial lines, generational lines, all groups in the survey said that it is manifestly unfair, the burden placed on black parents to have to discuss to their kids how to survive a police encounter. So that's one, you know, one very positive thing about the survey. So as promised, let me get to defund the police in this survey. This is a very, very sensitive issue, because a lot of people hear defund the police, and what they hear is, you know, how they interpret that is elimination of police departments. So within the survey, how was this question framed?
This is Sam. I guess I'll take that one.
Please.
So we asked about terminology used, and we asked about terminology specifically with defund the police. And the survey results were very mixed. You had 41% of the respondents support the term, and you had 44% oppose. And so that's kind of within the margin of error. And so we delved down a little bit deeper and said, well, what are your thoughts about reallocation of resources? What are your thoughts about developing civilian oversight panels and allocating money to improve community relations and improve de-escalation training? And what about body cameras? And in a poll like I've never seen before, you had 70, 80, 90% of people saying, yes, 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 we want those things. And so defund the police is a slogan that I'm not going to get into. I don't know where it originated from, but I think it's misleading, because a lot of people don't like that language, but like what reallocation of funding means. And that's essentially what's at the basis of kind of re-strategizing how we use our public dollars to prevent crime and reduce crime, instead of just responding to it with boots on the ground.
Right. And one last question, and then we have to finish up. Last week, we spoke with Broward County Sheriff Gregory Toney about the quote-unquote bad apples theory. Now, a different study out of the University of Miami examined explicit and implicit biases among police officers and found that regardless of race, a higher percentage of officers show bias compared to the general public. Now, we asked Sheriff Toney, who is Black, if he was surprised about Black officers showing bias or prejudice toward Black men in their community, and this was the response.
What I have seen in my own experience is that there becomes that level of biases even amongst Black officers, even those who have experienced racism themselves. And I think that is part of the long-term institutional things that are generated inside of any agency. And then it finds its way out into the streets. It finds its way out into the patrol officers, whether it be Black, white, Hispanic, or other. And so the idea that racism exists or implicit bias exists only when we do white officers versus the Black community, that is a falsehood. And I think the statistics just prove that in the study.
And Minka, we have to wrap it up. So very quickly, can you speak to us very quickly about the dual problems facing Black officers?
Of course. So I want to be clear that there's about 30 years of research around the brain science and the cognitive science around implicit bias. And it is clear that, you know, we all human beings are going to possess a certain degree of bias. I mean, you could go on and take a test yourself if you want to see where you stand. But I think it's interesting that one of the challenges of Black officers is that they're not only Black, but once they assume the role of an officer, they are also blue. And so mm-hmm. there is that dichotomy between having to live in these two different spaces. And so I think Sheriff Toney's points are very relevant to this discussion, and that this is an ongoing challenge and it needs to be mitigated. And so it's not enough to just inform and train on implicit bias, but really do something about applying that to the behavior that's executed on our streets.
We've been speaking with Dr. Minka Brantley, professor of psychology at Miami-Dade College, and also with Samantha Carlo, associate professor in the school's Department of Criminal Justice. You can read more about the poll on the public's attitudes toward policing by going to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Minka, Samantha, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for your time.
Still to come, the Festival of Lights will likely hold new meaning in 2020. We explore some of the history and culture behind Hanukkah. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Christine DiMatte, filling in for Luis Hernandez. Coming toward the end of what has been a very dark year for so many people, the first day of the yearly Festival of Lights begins tonight. Like most other holidays throughout this year of COVID-19, the celebration of Hanukkah in many households may be a subdued affair compared to previous years, but many of South Florida's Jewish organizations are gamely finding ways to honor the holiday with food and toy drives and drive-through extravaganzas and the like. Among non-Jews, Hanukkah is perhaps the most recognizable and popular Jewish holiday on the calendar, but it wasn't always that way. Avi Hoffman is a South Florida playwright and actor. He's perhaps best known for his one-man shows titled Too Jewish. It's actually a question mark at the end of that, Too Jewish. We'll get to that in a second. Avi is also the founder of the South Florida-based Yiddishkeit Initiative. The nonprofit is dedicated to promoting Jewish history, life, and culture. Avi, welcome.
I am so excited to be here with you, especially on this wonderful holiday of light and miracles.
We are happy to have you, and I'm going to put you on the spot. How do you say happy holidays both in Yiddish and Hebrew?
Gut Yontev in Yiddish and Chag Sameach in Hebrew.
I'm going to try that, but I may try that off air if you don't mind, Avi.
Sure, that's fine.
I have to tell you, after I graduated college, I worked for a company in Borough Park, Brooklyn, run by Hasidic and Orthodox Jews. And
yes.
that very first December, I was looking around the office and I did not see any paper dreidels on the wall, no menorah in the window. And I inquired and they went, no, we don't make a big deal about it. So that surprised me. How profound a holiday is Hanukkah on the Jewish calendar?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, it's the only Jewish holiday that's not in the Bible or in the Torah or in any of the commentaries, you know, because it came much, much later. In 200 BC, 2200 years ago, 2220 years ago, there was this big uprising where the Jews fought against the Romans who were trying to kill them and force them into, you know, lots of, you know, it's the old story. They tried to kill the Jews. They failed. Let's eat.
Oh, oh my
so,
goodness.
You know, basically that's how we look at many of our holidays. But it never made it into the Bible because the Bible came before. So actually Hanukkah does show up in the New Testament as the feast of dedication that Jesus attended, but it does not show up in the Jewish Orthodox traditions. So this was a holiday that was kind of added later on and became adopted. And the Jewish world wanted to, you know, Jewish kids used to look at the non-Jewish kids getting all these presents on Christmas. And they were like, well, why can't we get presents? And so Hanukkah kind of became a holiday, not only celebrating freedom, not only celebrating light, you know, the story of the oil that was only for one day and it lasted for 8 days and what a miracle. So this is a celebration of miracles.
What exactly, let me interrupt you. What exactly are the origins? What's the story? We hear about the Maccabees. So can you tell us the story?
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, basically, in a nutshell, the Maccabees beat back, you know, the Romans and ended up taking back the temple, the great Jewish temple in Jerusalem. And they, you know, fixed it up and put up a eternal light, right? There's always a light burning in the temple. But they only had enough oil for one day. And to get the olive oil that was processed in order to burn had to come. And it was like days and days away. Well, that little oil that, you know, for one day's worth of fire ended up miraculously lasting for 8 days, and thus the miracle of Hanukkah. And that's why we cook a lot of stuff in oil.
And I'm gonna get to the feast a little later, but at what point did Hanukkah start to gain popularity among American Jews?
You know, that's actually a very good question. I'm not sure I'm qualified to give you a definitive answer, but I would say, you know, towards the middle of the 20th century, you know, the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, again, as the Jews were becoming more Americanized. You know, don't forget, the vast bulk of Jewish immigration to the United States came in the mid-1880s, early 1900s. By the 20s, 30s, 40s, the Jews had become assimilated and part of the American, you know, part of American mainstream culture. You know, we were composing and theater and film and television and comedy, and we were becoming Americans. And suddenly there was this Christmas that the Jews looked at and went, well, we need to have something that can be ours around this time. And, you know, there was an old tradition of the feast of the end of, you know, the harvest. And so that 8 day feast kind of transferred into becoming part of what became Hanukkah. But I'd say probably, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s and beyond.
But still, even though Hanukkah is your own, it's got to be the tug of war between Christmas and Hanukkah is apt to be confusing. So in your childhood, Avi, when you were growing up, you know, how bad was the yearning for Santa Claus? Was there any Christmas angst in your household?
You know, I'm unique in the sense that I grew up in a very Yiddish immigrant, refugee, Holocaust survivor household. So we really didn't have any Christmas. Every day I was at a Yiddish school studying Yiddish and learning Yiddish and singing in Yiddish after public school every day. So Christmas was nowhere in my, Santa Claus was an abstract. It wasn't really anything in my childhood personally. And then by the time I was 11, we moved to Israel where there was absolutely none of that. And so for me personally, Christmas was never an issue. But I have a lot of friends, and a lot of friends have children. And so, you know, I don't know that it's a struggle as much as it's a mutual celebration. We want to be able to all celebrate together, you know, and right. then, you know, and then Kwanzaa came along. And so now there's Chrismachana Kwanzaa, you know, so basically we're all celebrating the miracle of life.
And absolutely. I'm speaking with Avi Hoffman, local playwright, actor, and founder of the South Florida-based Yiddishkeit Initiative. That nonprofit celebrates and promotes Jewish history, life, and culture. Once again, today marks the beginning of the Festival of Lights. You can learn more about the events happening throughout South Florida around the holiday by visiting our website, WLRN.org. And Avi, you just mentioned that in the latter half of your childhood, you were in Israel, so you had the unique opportunity of seeing how this holiday was celebrated in both countries. What are the biggest differences between American and Israeli Hanukkah?
Well, kind of like your experience in a way. In Israel, there is a very large Orthodox Jewish community, obviously, and they were not really celebrating Hanukkah in any significant way. And then there's a very large secular or less Orthodox community that celebrated the holiday because it had become traditional. You know, it's folklore. It's interesting. I look at all of the holidays, not only Hanukkah, as a magnificent legacy of folklore and tradition. These are stories. These are songs that were passed down from generation to generation. And, you know, everybody knows the songs. I am a little dreidel. They made me out of clay. You know,
yep, Hanukkah, I know that one.
Hanukkah. Right. But I sing them in Yiddish, right? Chanukah, Chanukah, yon tefashene. Alustika, frelech, enito, nochanene. You know, so all these songs for me were actually in the Yiddish, Ashkenazi world. In Israel, it was kind of the same. We had the traditions of lighting the menorahs and singing the songs and especially eating fried food. That's what it really boiled down to.
Okay, so yeah, I got to tell you.
Latkes, man. Let's eat sufganiyot and jelly-filled donuts and potato pancakes with applesauce and sour cream. You know, the food is where we really found our celebration.
But you told me the other day, actually, that the potato latkes are cooked with a lot of oil. And is this true, really, that since this is sort of a miracle of how long the oil lasted, that's the reason that there's so...
Yes,
that's the explanation behind the potato latkes and the jelly donuts and everything. Truly?
That's right. We're celebrating oil.
Now, I don't suppose you've got a low fat version of all of those.
Oh, absolutely not. This is instant heart disease. This is, you know, cholesterol heaven. But it's so delicious. And if you let yourself go a day, you know, a couple of days a year, it's not the end of the world. It's really good. Especially now.
Avi, solve a mystery for me. Yes. Since childhood, this has mystified me. How is Hanukkah spelled? Is it the CH? Is it an H? Is it a 1K or 2? Does it end with an H or not? And why the different spellings? Why do people play loosey-goosey with the spellings?
So the answer to your question is yes. you know, the reasoning, you know, look, to this day, if you ask, you know, three different Jews how to spell or pronounce a given word in Yiddish or Hebrew, you'll probably get three different versions. And that's, you know, just because of the way the dialects were and the way things were spelled were based on the sound of it, especially in Yiddish, and eventually the way it transliterated into English. So, you know, Hanukkah with a CH, I prefer the HANUKKAH, but everybody has their own version and they're all correct. There is no right or wrong here.
And Avi, the Yiddishkeit Initiative, of which you're a founder, hears from and reaches out to Jews worldwide. And sometimes to assess the future of a particular tradition, we look to what young people have to say about it. So when it comes to Hanukkah, the significance of it, the future of it, what sort of messages have you been getting from young Jews around the globe?
Well, I think, young is such a relative term, isn't it? But there are so many millennials and Gen Xers now that are starting to discover this amazing world of what I call Yiddishkeit, right, which is Jewishness. This culture that has been around for thousands of years. And in many cases for me, this love of the Yiddish language, which has been around for over 1,000 years and for many years was neglected and is now rediscovered. But, one of the things we do to attract more young people is we do these virtual festivals and we present all these great artists from all over the world virtually now, okay, since COVID.
And I have to get this in real quick because we have to move on. Your organization, sure, has a 4-day virtual Hanukkah festival planned for this year. Very quickly, because we have to go, please tell us about what you're launching tomorrow.
Well, it's amazing. 4 days of celebrating, new programming, concerts, Hanukkah, miracles, shimmering lights concert with Yael Strom, one of the world's top experts in klezmer music, who wrote the Book of Klezmer. We have children's programming. We have the Yidlife Crisis Boys, who work with Mayim Bialik and Howie Mandel. They're from Montreal. They're Gen Xers who created something called Yid Life Crisis, and they're doing a Chanukiah side chat.
So
a fireside chat.
So full 4-day online festival.
Oh, right? Yeah.
Okay.
New York Cantor concerts. We have on LRN the other day was Soy Korolenko and Anna Sternschiss with their Grammy nominated program, Yiddish Glory. And they're doing a thing called Laughing Against Fascism. So yes, we're celebrating the miracle of survival, the miracle of Hanukkah through song and laughter and celebration and schmoozing. Variety talk
sounds
shows.
Sounds wonderful.
I'm doing
wonderful.
A show called Schmoozing with Avi. So come and join us at yiddishfest.org.
Okay, thank you. We've been speaking with Avi Hoffman, local playwright, actor, and founder of the South Florida-based Yiddishkeit Initiative. You can find its website at whyilovejewish.org. That's Y-I, first two letters in the word Yiddish, lovejewish.org. And as you just heard, for 4 days starting tomorrow, the organization will be co-sponsoring a free virtual Hanukkah celebration with a full lineup of entertainment and educational programming. And you can find complete info at WLRN.org. Coming up, a ghost in the machine. Actually, there are three. A South Florida theater company gets ready to tell the tale of how Charles Dickens came to write A Christmas Carol. That's just ahead.
Light one candle for the Maccabee children, with thanks their light didn't die. Light one candle for the pain they endured when their right to exist was denied. Light one candle for the terrible sacrifice justice and freedom demand. But light one candle for the wisdom to know when the peacemaker's time is at hand. Don't let the light go out. It's lasted for so many.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The year was 1843. The author was deeply in debt. His wife was pregnant with their fifth child, and revenue from his last few works was dwindling. He wrote something quick, in only 6 weeks, and paid for the publishing costs himself. That author was Charles Dickens, and that something was A Christmas Carol. The story of how he came to write the enduring holiday classic was told in the 2008 novel The Man Who Invented Christmas by South Florida-based author Les Standiford. In 2017, it made it to the big screen in a film starring Christopher Plummer. And now a streaming online version will be going up just in time for Christmas by What If Works. The nonprofit helps young artists in theater, film, and music transition from academics to the professional realm. And we're talking with Philip Church, What If Works artistic director and longtime theater professor at Florida International University. Philip, welcome.
Oh, Christine, thank you. It's a joy to be here.
It's a joy to have you. Philip, between the publication of Les Standiford's book and the movie version, there were about 10 years. So when did Standiford write the play version of this story?
Well, he wrote the play actually as soon as the film was released. He just got the idea that he saw the book now as a live stage production. So he sat down and penned the stage play. Yeah.
Now, the title of the novel, play, and movie is The Man Who Invented Christmas. And that sort of implies that the holiday barely existed before the publication of A Christmas Carol. So what exactly is meant by that title?
Well, you know, Christmas was in England and most of Europe at that time quite a pagan ritual. And
how do you mean? How do you mean pagan?
Well, you know, it was celebrated out in the countryside, but not in the cities. It was a very sort of Puritan approach to Christmas, and so Dickens writing A Christmas Carol actually injected and through the readership of the story of the little book injected this whole rebirth of celebrating Christmas, and Christmas trees started to appear in London and in cities, in fact. But Christmas wasn't being celebrated at that time. You know, Victorian England, very, very strict, very stark, and somewhat, it's just a tradition that wasn't
Dickens sort of, the book sort of popularized certain foods like the roast turkey and the Yorkshire pudding, and
that's right,
you know, and some people even claim that the words Merry Christmas, you know, that stretches back to the 1500s, but even that, you know, that salutation Merry Christmas was even popularized.
Yeah. Is that that's true? That's right. The book was incredibly influential in bringing about what we now know as Christmas and how we celebrate it today. I don't think too many people are aware that A Christmas Carol, the story, which everybody loves and very often, of course, appears on the stage each year, was the driving force to sort of rekindling the tradition and celebration.
So here's a little preview from the What If Works Zoom version. In this scene, Dickens is speaking with his wife, Catherine, about their dire financial situation.
And I haven't the foggiest idea what I'll write next.
Darling, you've always come up with something.
How about the last few books? Sunk like anchors, all of them.
You're a brilliant writer, Charles. If the public can't appreciate that, it is their loss.
So, Philip, how long did you have this project in mind? Was it planned before the pandemic or actually during the health crisis?
Yeah, well, I think the listeners need some context to what this production is. It's actually a staged reading, but it's been given a great deal of theatricalization. All the actors are remote. They are recorded separately because the pandemic arrived, and this project was actually developed in May. That was a time when very few of us really had a handle on how to use Zoom as a performance medium. And so, you know, we're all scrambling, trying to work it out, and, you know, both in education and also in entertainment as well. But Les and I have been talking about mounting the production for over a year. And we got into discussions, pandemic arrived. And I said to Les, listen, why don't we do a stage reading, which means we could bring 16 actors together and they wouldn't be off book, what's called off book, but you would get a chance to really listen to the play and see where it needs developing and so on before we actually get to a live production, which will be when theaters open and we can discuss it with a producer and so forth. So we did, but then I started to see that the project could be really beneficial in that it could possibly be something that could go into the recording, could go into nursing homes, into assisted living facilities. I approached Camilla's House, and they currently, during the month of December, are actually screening it for their residents. And we're also, working with Feeding South Florida now. And,
oh, yes.
What your interview is sort of focused on are the 3 days of streaming, where that hopefully will raise some money for the food insecurity that's going on.
Yes, and it couldn't.
Yeah.
It couldn't have come at a better time, Philip, because if you read the Miami Herald article, actually today talks about how food organizations that feed the poor throughout South Florida are just bleeding money. So the fact that you're raising funds for Feeding South Florida, perfect time for it, and something that would make Dickens himself proud, because he had firmly in mind, he was deeply affected by the suffering of the poor, and that figures prominently in his story.
Absolutely, absolutely. Poverty and education too. So the focus of the presentation very much on things that we are concerned with today. So instead of just this being a state reading, and in fact, the viewers who sign on will watch Les, the playwright, actually reading his own stage directions, and then of course the action is theatricalized around that. But
that's lovely. So the author plays a role in this as well as Scrooge and as well as Dickens.
that's right. Yeah. So the viewers are getting a sort of real literary dose of listening to the stage directions, and then they're seeing the dramatic scenes played out between the characters.
And Philip, when you're working with a Zoom production, you told me a couple of minutes ago that, you had to scramble and adapt. And we've been speaking, WLRN has been speaking to a lot of artists and arts organizations who have pretty much had to do the same thing, learned Zoom and other online platforms from the ground up. So what room, when you're doing something like this, what room does a Zoom production leave for special effects? Anything at all?
Well, you just need a really good editor, someone. And also, I'm here to tell you, Christine, you need an editor who truly understands theater. And, that's kind of not easy to find. But Paul Steinsland, who is the technical director of the School of Music here at FIU, he and I have worked on a couple of projects in the past. And Paul came on board and we shot... or I should say we recorded, because it's not film, okay? So we can't start talking about filming things. We recorded the project in the course of a week, okay? So the actors had one rehearsal, which is standard for stage readings, okay? And then we recorded in a week, and then Paul, for 2 months, literally every day, went through all the recordings and put together. So you've got virtual backgrounds behind the action, behind the actors, that denote Manchester or London or the dark seamy streets. And I think the audience will really enjoy the fact that even though it's a stage reading, it's highly theatrical. There are sound effects. There's music. We've done our best, but it is important to remember that it's a stage reading and it's not this full filmed production,
And Philip, I have one last question for you and then we must go. But both of these stories, A Christmas Carol and The Man Who Invented Christmas, both have very positive messages. Now, Philip, you've been very outspoken yourself about the fact that you feel that theater and film can be a tool for social change. Now, very, very quickly, how is that reflected in your directing and your teaching?
Yeah, well, I think the fact that Les gave us the opportunity, and I do want to do a shout out to Homestead Center for the Arts, because this couldn't have been possible without a grant from them. And they're a wonderful organization in Homestead. They've been supporting us for a few years now. And they gave us a grant to be able to develop this so we could pay the actors and so forth. So what is wonderful about this project is that we not only can send a message out through the text, through the dialogue, but we can also do something with this project for local organizations that are in need, such as, you know, Feeding South Florida. And I think when theater and film can move into those territories where not only the piece itself is saying something and has a message, but also the actual event itself can raise money for other organizations, that's truly, well, that's everything.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Philip Church, Artistic Director of What If Works. Their production of The Man Who Invented Christmas will be streaming online starting next week, December 19th, 20th, and 21st. You can find more details about the shows and how you can support Feeding South Florida by going to our social media at WLRN Sundial. And that's all the time that we have for Sundial. Today, Thursday, December 10th. Sundial's senior producer is Chris Remington. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Surya Reimer is our intern. Our news director is Taryn Shepherd. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka. Our technical supervisor is Peter J. Maris. Our theme music is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo. At gopalo.com, you can download a podcast of this program. Please search WLRN Sundial on your podcast app. And by the way, you've been listening to Black Violin's rendition of Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. We spoke with the band earlier this week for the new season of Live from the 305. Please head to our website to listen back to the interview and hear more holiday tunes. I'm Christine DiMatte. Thank you so much for listening. Luis Hernandez will be back next week.